The Fort Lauderdale Police Department is facing criticism for the actions of two of its officers in recent protests. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. One officer is being investigated by the state for pushing a protester who was already kneeling to the ground. Another is facing an internal investigation for firing a rubber bullet at a protester from close proximity. Also, COVID-19 deaths at nursing homes continue climbing at a faster rate than the rest of Florida's population. What sort of transparency do these facilities have to have? And why are their workers not getting enough PPEs? Finally, recent college graduates are entering one of the worst job markets in decades. How has the pandemic shaped their views about the future?
So everybody's been telling me, you know, a few months, we'll be hiring in a few months. So hopefully by the end of the year, I have a job.
All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Well, what you're hearing is protests. They continued across South Florida over the weekend from Jupiter down to Homestead, focused on police brutality. The protests remained relatively peaceful, although a number of arrests were made. Meanwhile, Fort Lauderdale police are continuing to face scrutiny over protests that became violent more than a week ago. Officer Stephen Poherence is under internal investigation, captured on video pushing over a kneeling protester. During the same protest, police fired tear gas and rubber bullets into the crowd, striking another protester in the face and fracturing her skull. The Miami Herald's Sarah Blasky and Nicholas Nehamas join us now to discuss these stories. Sarah, Nicholas, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Sarah, let me start with you. I want to start with the case of Latoya Ratliff, and she's the protester who was struck in the face by the rubber bullet during the demonstrations in Fort Lauderdale. Where is that story right now? What's happening?
So Latoya Ratliff is a 34-year-old from South Florida, and she was at the protest and demonstrating peacefully. In fact, she was participating in calming down protesters who had been agitated by that shove that you mentioned earlier, and the officer shoving the kneeling woman. And despite the fact that the crowd had been mainly under control by that point, police continued to throw tear gas at the protesters. And so Latoya tried to leave. And as she was leaving, she was shot in the face with a rubber bullet. A foam baton is what they call this particular type of rubber bullet. She has retained counsel and has communicated her intentions to the city to seek reform.
What has the police department said about the incident and her being struck in the face?
So the messaging has always been, since the first time we spoke with the police chief, he said that this incident stood out as a potential violation of police protocols in Fort Lauderdale. The Fort Lauderdale police protocols around using these quote-unquote less lethal munitions state very clearly that they should not be shot at anyone's head unless deadly force is warranted. These types of munitions can be deadly when shot at the head. And so the police are opened an internal investigation into the officer who shot Latoya.
And Sarah, remind us, I mean, these foam rubber bullets, they're allowed to be used by officers.
They are allowed to be used by officers. They're considered a crowd control, ammunition used in crowd control situations. That said, they are deadly if they hit you in the face or the neck or the groin area. They can be deadly. And so there are very sort of strict protocols around how they are used. There's also, you know, a sort of minimum distance that is recommended. Latoya was only about 10 yards, 30 feet away from the officer who shot her. And Nick and myself both witnessed this shooting happen at the time we were reporting.
Nicholas, the police department, are they still asking residents or people who were there to share videos as part of an investigation?
They are. They have asked the public to share photo and video of the protest generally and Ms. Ratliff's shooting in particular. You know, it's worth noting that there is a fair amount of video and photo documentation of what happened already on social media and published by the Herald and now being shared, you know, nationally on CNN and other platforms. And just to emphasize, you know, what Sarah said, Ms. Ratliff was being led away by the hand by another protester from a cloud of tear gas, choking, coughing, and vomiting when an officer shot her in the head, which again, you know, it, according to Fort Lauderdale Police's own training, should only take place in a situation where deadly force has been authorized.
And first of all, asking for video from, you know, from residents, is that normal? Is that a normal practice?
I've seen that happen in the past. I haven't seen it happen so far in these protests in South Florida.
Do we have any guarantee, though, that the police aren't using those videos to possibly charge protesters?
Well, that's a really important point, and that's something that, you know, has clearly occurred to protesters and organizers who are concerned about that very risk that the video could be used to charge people. And, you know, the police in their plea for video, you know, did not say that we're only looking for video of Ms. Ratliff's case. You know, they're looking, they've also said that they believe that this violence was caused by what they call outside agitators. And I think it's very possible that they're looking to identify those people that they believe were there and potentially charge them.
Sarah, as you said, Ms. Ratliff has an attorney. Now, she's seeking reform, but do we know anything about potential legal action against the city or police?
So Ms. Ratliff has not released her list of demands or the reforms that she's seeking from the city or the police, has just sort of generally spoken about it at this point. In terms of legal action, what we understand from her attorneys is that there are a wide range of options available, including a federal civil rights case. Now, she has not filed anything. She has not filed an official complaint with the police department yet. The last we spoke to the attorneys, our understanding is that they're waiting for a meeting with the city, and that's going to be the first step, and then they'll consider other legal options.
And she said that right now she's seeking reform, right?
That's correct.
Okay. Well, what does that mean? What is she asking for exactly?
So, again, she hasn't released a list of specific demands, but she has made it very clear on multiple occasions, speaking with both local and national media, that she is interested in meaningful reforms in the police department. I don't want to put words into her mouth and say what those might be. We've certainly heard protesters around the country calling for reforms, calling for citizen advisory boards or reviews of uses of force and that kind of thing. But we don't know yet from Ms. Ratliff whether or not she is seeking that type of reform or something else.
Nicholas, what do we know about the officer involved in that? That name hasn't been released yet.
Yeah, that's right. We don't know anything about the officer. We do know from police last time we spoke with them that this officer has not been relieved of duty, and the investigation continues.
I'm talking with the Miami Herald's Sarah Blasky and Nicholas Nehamas. A protester in Fort Lauderdale, again, was struck in the face by a foam rubber bullet during the protest more than a week ago. The incident now being investigated. Another officer that same day being investigated by the state, Stephen Poherence, you know, again, for shoving a protester who was already kneeling, shoving that protester to the ground. You can read Sarah and Nick's reporting on this. Go to our social media at WLRN Sundial. Just a note, by the way, we have put in a request to speak with the Fort Lauderdale police chief about this. And we are going to be talking with Fort Lauderdale's mayor tomorrow. Dean Trantalis will be on the program. Nicholas, we have heard from police about the use of tear gas and these less than lethal tools, you know, to try to understand why. What have the police said about why they use these? Why not something else less? Because even though it's a less than lethal tool, Again, it can be lethal if you strike somebody in the head at close range.
Right. So, you know, it's worth just looking back at the whole day, which was completely peaceful. You know, protesters and police did not engage with each other. The organizers were very clear with you know, the people marching, don't approach the police, don't say anything, you know, don't give them any reason. And the day really went off without a hitch up until around 7 p.m. And that's when the police chief says that an officer in a police vehicle was surrounded by protesters and sent out a distress call, and that led to a confrontation with the use of tear gas. Now, we've asked for records about that distress call and what happened. We have not received them, but it seems, according to the police, that that's when Officer Perharens entered the crowd. Things had calmed down at this point. He shoved the woman in the head. Protesters got angry, and the police deployed tear gas, and then things calmed down again, you know, in part thanks to Ms. Ratliff, who was urging people to stay calm. And then, for reasons that have not been explained, you know, the police started again using tear gas and shooting rubber bullets.
Sarah, what do we know about Officer Perharens?
So, we don't know a lot. We do know that Officer Perharens has been investigated for use of force over his career in Fort Lauderdale, and those are routine investigations. He's never been found having, you know, committed any misconduct or anything like that as a result of those investigations. He's also recently pulled his weapon about once a month, according to internal files, in his police file. So beyond that, you know, all we can say is Officer Perharens has been relieved from active duty pending this investigation. However, he has not been dismissed from the force or anything like that.
Do we know anything about, you know, protocols when we have an officer who's had that many complaints filed against them, or if we know that they have pulled their weapon that many times? Is that considered a lot, first of all, and other? What's the protocol? And you know, how an officer is, I guess, disciplined, you know, for any activity.
To be clear, in Fort Lauderdale and in many places around the country, use of force can mean anything from using some sort of restraint or hold to a much more serious use of force. And every time that there is any sort of use of force, the department investigates that. So it's not that Officer Perharens had all these complaints against him, but rather that these routine use of force investigations had happened.
Nicholas, continue, please.
In terms of, is that a lot? I've heard conflicting points of view. Some of our sources in police departments say yes, some say no. And until we have more information about the specifics of Fort Lauderdale, it's a little bit hard to say.
And I think if I remember from the reporting that you've done, the two of you have done, that this particular officer had been on the force since 2016, and there were 79 of these complaints or these issues, right? Did I read right?
There was an investigation into 79 uses of force in that time. That's correct.
Okay. Nicholas, what's the role of the union right now in protecting officers, you know, especially when you have situations like that of Perharens?
Police unions are very active and very vocal. I mean, you might have seen, you know, the Brevard County Police Union offered, you know, jobs, and it's just a symbol, but offered jobs to the officers in Buffalo who were fired and criminally charged after pushing over that 75-year-old man up there. So, you know, these unions stick together, and they're very influential politically. You know, I think it's interesting that Mayor Trentalis was much quicker to condemn the actions of Officer Perharens than he was to talk about the incident with LaToya Ratliff, where he originally, you know, said that, well, she shouldn't have been in the area at that time. I wouldn't be there if I saw tear gas and rubber bullets being used. And in the days that have followed, he's kind of caught the political winds and shifted what he said about the incident.
Yeah, and we'll bring it up with him tomorrow. What do we know about the protest? They've continued on, you know, over the weekend, but what do we know about future protests and what this movement is doing right now?
Well, the protests certainly seem to be continuing. Over the weekend, there were more. You saw, you know, someone like Mitt Romney marching on the White House over the weekend as well. So, you know, from our perspective, we are prepared to cover these protests at the Miami Herald and El Nuevo Herald for the foreseeable future.
We've been talking with the Miami Herald's Nicholas Nehamas, also Sarah Blasky, covering the protests over the last little more than a couple of weeks, almost a couple of weeks now here in South Florida. You can read more of their stories on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Sarah, Nicholas, thank you so much. I really appreciate the time.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Well, still to come, one in five nursing homes say they don't have the protective gear they need. Do you have a family member in a nursing home? Maybe you work at one? We want to hear from you. Call in 800-743-9576. More to come. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. As Florida continues to reopen and relax social distancing rules, coronavirus cases and deaths among the most vulnerable continue to mount. Last month, COVID-19-related deaths at nursing homes and assisted living facilities tripled in the state. And new data released by the federal government shows that nearly one in five Florida nursing homes say they do not have enough personal protective equipment, like masks and gowns, to care for the patients. We want to hear from you. Do you have a family member in a nursing home? Maybe you work at a nursing home. We want to hear your stories. Call in 800-743-9576. That's 800-743-WLRN. Find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. Again, we want to hear from you, and we want to know what's really going on in those nursing homes. Joining us now is Ben Weider. He is the data reporter at McClatchy's Washington Bureau, and he's been working closely with the Miami Herald. Ben, thanks so much for the time.
Thanks so much for having me.
So healthcare workers at these nursing homes are trying to sound the alarm, and they've been doing it for a while now, about not having the protective gear they need. What are you hearing from them?
We hear stories of frontline nursing home workers who are forced to reuse equipment that's designed to be used once. In some cases, you know, they bring in equipment themselves from home if their nursing home hasn't been able to give them sufficient equipment, and you know, and they're scared. You know, the reality is what we know about COVID-19 is that it's highly transmissible. It's very infectious. And when you're working closely with patients who have the virus or are suspected of having the virus, you know, it's impossible to, you know, without this protective gear, you really put yourself at great risk.
What about the management? I mean, is it the management has the gear, they're not getting it to the workers, or the management doesn't even have it?
In many cases, in some cases at least, you know, one out of five homes said this, according to the federal data, they don't have enough. You know, most of them have some. They have some, you know, degree of masks. They have some degree of gowns. They have some eye protection and gloves. But the question is that, you know, the issue is that they just don't have enough. You know, the federal data asks them, do you have any? And do you have enough for a week? And not having enough is what results in people reusing things that aren't intended to be reused.
Yeah, they're being asked to reuse their equipment.
Exactly. These are instances where, you know, this is the type of equipment where in normal circumstances, you know, you put on a pair of gloves when you walk in to see a patient. When you walk out, you throw those gloves in the trash. You put on the mask when you're dealing with a patient who's sick. You take it off and throw it in the trash as soon as you're done. That's the intended purpose for this equipment. But time and time again, we hear stories of people who have to reuse it because there just isn't enough. And it's difficult. I mean, as we've reported, you know, the state has certainly tried to ramp up its effort to get this equipment, and nursing homes and other long-term care facilities have tried to get this equipment on their own. But, you know, it's really a question of both timing and the fact that everyone is looking for this at the same time. So there's this huge crush of demand for this equipment, and there's only so much that exists.
Again, we want to hear from you. If you work in a nursing home or you have a family member in a nursing home, you've had the chance to see anything that's going on, we want to hear from you as to what's really happening. Call in 800-743-9576. That's 800-743-9576, or find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. So, Ben, the state's Division of Emergency Management said that Florida should have 10 million masks in reserve before the start of hurricane season. And they've repeatedly claimed that there are no shortages. So is that true?
You know, we certainly know that they ramped up their purchasing of masks. You know, we've written about the efforts they made to ramp up their masks, and they've obtained millions of masks. That much is true. And you know, certainly we have to give them credit for really trying very hard to do this. With that said, you know, on the ground, many nursing homes still feel like they don't have enough. And so, you know, despite the best efforts of the state to try to obtain these masks, nursing homes and other long-term care facilities on the ground are still saying it's not enough.
Wait a minute. So the state said they're getting the masks, millions of these. They've got them, or they've got a lot. Where's the issue then? How come it's not getting to some of these nursing homes?
I think the issue, it's sort of twofold. One, it's a timing thing. You know, the question of how many masks they could obtain was in part a question of when they started trying to get those masks. So if you think about it, you know, COVID-19, we first start hearing about it, you know, earlier part of this year, you know, maybe in China, you know, starting to come out, trickle out the end of 2019. But as we reported earlier, you know, the state of Florida doesn't really start ramping up its efforts until probably about March. By that point, many other states are already scrambling to get these masks. The federal government is scrambling to get these masks. And you know, the federal government has been criticized for not being fast enough in ramping up their acquisition of this protective equipment, but they were still ahead of where Florida was. So they were effectively playing catch up. And, you know, to their credit, they have obtained a lot of masks and a lot of other equipment since then. But, you know, the demand hasn't died away. I mean, the reality is, while much of the state of Florida is starting to reopen, and it might feel like in some parts of the state COVID-19 is starting to go away, in nursing homes this is an ever-present issue.
Right.
This has not died down in nursing homes. This has continued to ravage nursing homes, and so this need hasn't diminished in any way in nursing homes.
And again, as we point out, we're hearing stories of people in these nursing homes reusing equipment. So please, again, we want to hear from you. 800-743-9576. Let me go to Jose in Miami. Jose, welcome to the program.
Yes, good afternoon. Thank you.
Yes. So, Jose, tell me what you've seen.
So I just want to tell you, for 25 years, I own and manage 89 ALF beds. As far as the PPE, the supplies, in three occasions, the EOC, and they sent me out to Medley, and I get a call out of the blue. There's a request for this equipment. Now, I want to let you know that I use 960 masks every 4 weeks. I'm not issuing any of the face shields or KN95 because I have no COVID. I was the first facility that tested 23 employees and 47 residents simultaneously on my own. And this is with the swab, which is the most accurate of them all. Going back to the PPE for a moment, if I had to get PPE right now, I can get it. Any nursing home can get it in any ALF. But the cost is so exorbitant that you can't have extra supplies, as we're much very used to with most of our items that were in great need. To get a mask, to get a KN95, because there is no N95, if there's a KN95, it will cost you $7. I'm buying still surgical masks at $1. Every 4 weeks, I spend $1,000. I give one mask per shift, and depending what happens with that that employee, I have to give maybe a second mask.
So then, real quickly, because you talk about that, you can get the equipment, it's the cost.
If you really look at what's happening, I think that what's not being looked at or reported is that they can get their hands on it. There's 1,000 distributors, but the gouging, the level of gouging is off the chain. And I think that a lot of facilities can't afford it, or they don't want to, I don't know, they don't want to make that investment.
Jose, this is an interesting point. And thank you so much for the call. Ben, you hear that. What's the issue with, one, where you can get it, but is it true, as he's saying, it's the cost that's prohibitive?
The cost is certainly an issue. And this speaks to what I was saying before about where the state was in terms of obtaining this equipment, and perhaps where facilities were in obtaining this equipment. You know, certainly if you started trying to get this equipment in January and February, when you first saw reports of COVID-19, the prices were a lot lower. Once we started getting into March, the prices spiked. When we did our, you know, when we did reporting on Florida's efforts to ramp up their acquisition of masks, what we saw was, you know, as time progressed, the masks got more expensive. And frankly, the masks, the source of those masks got less reliable. You know, Jared Moskowitz, the head of emergency management for the state, has talked repeatedly about, you know, trying to get masks from anyone who could offer it to him. You know, you show up to warehouses expecting a warehouse full of masks, turns out to be empty. And, you know, the masks that they did obtain in many cases were selling for many multiples of what they normally would sell for. So a mask that might normally cost $1 is now going for, you know, $6 or $7. And so that does present a challenge. You know, many nursing homes are not operating on huge margins. So, you know, there is a cost, factor as well. So, but again, it speaks to timing.
I'm trying to figure out then accountability here. Is it who, you know, looking for the accountability, is it the nursing homes or is it the state on trying to get the equipment to the nurses?
I mean, honestly, I think you have to say that there's elements of both. I mean, you know, it's a question of where, you know, it's a question of, you know, was the alarm sounded early enough about the need to ramp up acquisition of these materials? And then once it became clear that, you know, that this was a problem, were people doing enough to do that? And I think, so, you know, we've certainly raised questions about, you know, when was the state getting equipment? You know, when was the state learning from facilities that they had positive cases? What kind of testing has been done? And some of that is on the state, but some of that is that is on homes themselves. And you know, to be clear, you know, the state through the Agency for Healthcare Administration has been very active in looking at homes and facilities where there have been problems, and in fact has issued the most. We looked in May of this past month, in May of 2020, and they issued the most emergency actions in May 2020 than they had in practically a decade.
Yeah.
You have to go back to 2011.
I want to look into this here just a second. Again, I'm talking with Ben Weider, data reporter at McClatchy's Washington Bureau, talking about, first we were talking about the lack of personal protective equipment in nursing homes, but also we want to look at why the numbers for COVID-19 deaths so high in the state of Florida in nursing homes compared to the rest of the population. We still want to hear from you. If you work in a nursing home, you have a family member in a nursing home, what are you seeing? We'd love to hear your stories. 800-743-9576. That's 800-743-WLRN. Find us on social media at WLRN Sundial. So Ben, you know, the Agency for Healthcare Administration revised a rule last week about discharging COVID-19 positive residents back into these facilities, long-term facilities. What's the change? What'd they revise?
They basically said that you could be discharged to these facilities so long as the facility had, you know, enough equipment and had an effective protocol for isolating you. And the idea here is, you know, if you're going back into the facility, you want to be in an area of the facility where you couldn't infect other people. You know, we know that this is highly contagious. And so, you know, ideally what would happen is you're basically in a completely separate section of the facility, and everyone who interacts with you, every staff member who interacts with you, you know, has a full complement of protective gear, has a mask, has a face shield, has a gown, gloves, everything that is necessary to prevent the spread, and that after they see you, they ideally would be getting rid of all of that so they don't spread it to someone else.
And all this information, how much of it's allowed to be, you know, shared with the public? How much transparency are they supposed to show and tell us all this?
It has been some of it is public. I mean, you know, credit, for example, the fact that we have this information from the federal government is a testament to the fact that they are, you know, asking questions and getting information they haven't asked for before and are committed to trying to get it out there. But from our end, you know, we have been sort of wrestling with the state for months to try to get this information out. You know, the state wasn't initially releasing information about positive cases in facilities, wasn't initially releasing information about deaths in facilities. And we actually had to, you know, file lawsuits along with other media organizations to get that information released. So it has been a challenge and a struggle for us to get access to this information. And there's other information we're continually trying to obtain from the state.
Yeah, there. I mean, you know, I wanted to know about the inconsistencies in the data that you find in the state reporting versus what's the federal government, because there are holes in the data.
Yeah, well, for starters, you know, in the first 2 weeks of this federal data, you know, each week, roughly 1 out of 7 nursing homes in the state have not reported. So right off the bat, you know, there's a huge chunk of the universe you're missing. There's about 700 nursing homes in the state. So you've got 100 facilities where we just don't have information in terms of what they're providing the federal government. And then I think, you know, what's clear in looking at the initial data that was released is that there was some confusion, I think, from homes, and there's been some issues with the quality of the data. Some homes reported, according to the data, that they had, you know, in one case, more than 100 COVID-19 deaths. You know, that was actually a mistake. They hadn't meant to say that. They had entered the information wrong. Because they're doing it for the first time, I think there have been some issues. And the federal government was clear that that was going to be the case. They made it clear to us when they released this data. We expect there to be changes over the next few weeks. This data is going to have fluctuations, but we want to get it out there even with the problems, because we think it's important to get this information to the public, even if it is flawed.
Yeah. I want to get to the phones. I'm going to go to Stephen in Aventura. Stephen, thanks for waiting. Welcome to the program.
Yeah, hi. I just wanted to make a comment. We are a freight forwarder, and we've been involved in shipping masks from China to the Caribbean and the U.S. And to put it in perspective, in normal circumstances, a trailer load or a container load from China to the United States, the freight cost is under $3,000. Now, to ship the equivalent of 7 trailers, which is what goes on a 747 aircraft, the cost is now about $1.1 to $1.5 million. So I've seen prices of surgical masks, FOB China, for roughly 25 cents a mask, and adding the freight to get them here, rush, that's the impact on the price that your guest is talking about. It's also going into the quote-unquote gouging. But it's a supply and demand, and there's limited aircraft, and everybody wants them here yesterday, and that's the price to get them shipped.
Shipping has gone up. Interesting. Stephen, thank you for the call. I appreciate the information. Ben, coming back to the data, you know, Governor DeSantis and the Florida Healthcare Association say that the state has fewer deaths per capita among nursing home residents compared to the rest of the country. Is that true?
That is absolutely true. And you know, Florida, you know, as we know across the board, you know, Florida has had fewer deaths per capita than many other big states. I mean, certainly when you think about states like New York and New Jersey up north, those were much harder hit by COVID-19 across the board. And you know, in nursing homes, they were much harder hit. In some cases, because of policies, you know, just now, the state is starting to allow some COVID-19 positive patients to be returned to homes in extreme circumstances. In New York, there were periods of time where lots of COVID-19 patients were being shipped to nursing homes early in the process, which led to a huge spike in cases in nursing homes. So, you know, to the state's credit, you know, other states were basically bringing the infection into nursing homes, Florida was doing a better job of making sure that nursing homes were more isolated.
And he put in very strict rules on visitation, which he says he wants to lift soon. But, you know, we're still waiting for the details on how that will happen. Ben Weider, again, data reporter at McClatchy's Washington Bureau. Check out his reporting on our social media, WLRN Sundial. Ben, thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much. I appreciate it. Thanks so much. Take care.
All right. Well, still to come, what does the job market look like for recent college grads? If you're part of the 2020 class or a parent of one, we want to hear from you. 800-743-9576. That's coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Thousands of college graduates across South Florida should be celebrating the end of an important chapter of their lives. Instead, they are facing the worst job market since the Great Depression amidst a global pandemic. 1 in 5 employers surveyed by the National Association of Colleges and Employers back in April said they were rescinding summer internships, and those usually lead to jobs. But some colleges are being resilient. Colby College, a small liberal arts school in Maine, says that they plan to ensure 100% of graduates have a job lined up. Well, class of 2020, we want to hear from you. How has the pandemic impacted your plans? Parents Are you welcoming those kids back home? 800-743-9576. That's 800-743-WLRN. Find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. Joining us now is Joshua Ceballos, a member of FIU's graduating class of 2020. He's got degrees in English and international business. Joshua, great to have you.
Thank you for having me.
Also joining us is John Nicolasian. He's the Director of Business Career Management at the Center at FIU. John, great to have you back.
Thanks. It's great to be back.
Joshua, I want to start with you. First of all, congratulations on graduating and getting through this part of your life and entering a new phase. But what's the last 3 months of your life been like?
Well, it's been a lot of sitting at home, basically. It's been a kind of a crazy ride. You know, this was my last semester at FIU, and you know that's supposed to be a big deal. Obviously, dealing with senioritis and not wanting to go to class, but also the big transition of, all right, now my life starts officially. And then all of that kind of got thrown in the basket with COVID-19, that at first we were like, is this really going to happen? And then, you know, I lived on campus. We were told to evacuate. We couldn't go back to campus. We had all of our classes online. And it just kind of felt like I'm in a weird limbo. But I've just been living at home for the past 3 months.
And my understanding is your plans were that you were going to go to Phoenix because you had a fellowship out there, right?
That's correct. Yeah, I had a fellowship to work at a newspaper out in Phoenix because I work in journalism. And I had emailed the paper asking, like, hey, when everything kind of started in mid-March, like, is everything still on? Am I going to be able to still go over there? I still have plans to travel. And basically I received an email saying that the fellowship was dissolved. They didn't have the money for fellowships because, you know, ad revenue has been severely cut with the pandemic. And that kind of went out the window, and I am now living in Miami. I'm not going to Phoenix.
Well, tell me what the job market looks like right now for grads. I mean, like, the thing about the jobs that you and people at your level that you've just finished school, what you're eligible to get, what does it look like right now? What's happening?
I mean, from everything that I've heard from friends and from my own experience is that, you know, just jobs are disappearing in a lot of different sectors and in a lot of different ways. I was subscribed to a few newsletters that had, journalism jobs, for instance. And I would always get a list of like 10 different places that were hiring in different positions. And I remember I've been struck because now since the pandemic, since when I get those emails, what was once a list of 10 is now maybe one or two. So jobs are just kind of poof, you know, disappearing all over the place.
Yeah. Wow. Again, the class of 2020 entering a very tough job market. We want to hear from you. If you are part of that class, what's changed for you? What, you know, what's the job search like? You know, what are your plans? Did you have to change them dramatically? And the parents, what are those conversations that you're having with your children? 800-743-9576. That's 800-743-WLRN. Or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. We heard from Natalie Rivera. She graduated in April from FIU with a biomedical engineering degree.
Before the coronavirus pandemic, I was feeling a lot more hopeful than I am now. I had been talking to a few companies and a few recruiters. I was even being considered for a position and I was being put through the whole hiring process. Now after COVID-19, after the pandemic, it's been a little disheartening because, you know, a lot of companies are on pause right now dealing with the pandemic, and any position that I was being considered for that I had applied for got retracted or put on hold. So everybody's been telling me, you know, a few months, we'll be hiring in a few months. So hopefully by the end of the year, I have a job.
Hopefully that or sooner. John, what are you hearing from students like Natalie and Joshua? What are they telling you? What's going on out there?
Well, it's not good. But I have seen a small uptick in some of the trends, but the competition is now incredibly fierce. And I apologize, I couldn't hear what Natalie said earlier. I did hear Josh, but I for some reason I couldn't hear Natalie.
Well, yeah, Natalie. I mean, basically, Natalie was saying a lot of the same things, which is, you know, that she was up for a position with recruiters, and then all of a sudden, that was taken away. And so now it was retracted, and they're telling her, well, everything's on hold.
Yeah, we've seen that with some employers, and the employers who've been able to pivot, the employers that have been able to pivot and make these experiences virtual have been the ones who've been able to keep the interns and the students and the recent hires warm, if you will. But that ability to pivot is, that continuum is vastly different on the spectrum from, you know, one employer to the other. There's no standard.
What are the conversations that you've had with some of the big companies here in South Florida that normally work with FIU to help find those jobs for graduates? What's going on with those?
It's a mixed bag. Some have canceled and said, you know, due to the pandemic, we are not going to be offering the internship program or this program. Some were doing virtuals and some have moved to virtual. So, you know, for example, one of our clients in Sunrise, unfortunately, right at the beginning, just had to shut everything down and was like, look, it's canceled, we're done. Our accounting firm clients have been able to pivot and move everybody to a virtual session. Now, it's important to note, it's not going to be the full 16-week experience. They've condensed it, shortened it. They've really done a good job in trying to keep it down. Well, keep it active for the students, but they've really, really pared it down.
And something you said, too, it's you got to pivot. So companies are having to pivot because of everything, which now means everybody else, you got to be ready to make a shift. I mean, like some of the key companies, for example, that FIU works with, Royal Caribbean and Carnival, yeah. And they hire graduates. But because what's happened to the tourism industry, you know, what are some of those pivoting skills you're telling your students who want to get into that industry?
Well, so it's funny that you mention Royal. I think they were the most interesting case when we saw this happen. Firms, we saw firms that weren't able to hire specifically in that industry, tourism, rental cars. What they were doing was they were keeping the brand warm and keeping the brand in the front minds of the students by engaging the students internally with our programming. And Royal did something very interesting. They did a webinar, a fully online webinar through our office called Opportunity Preparation and Reducing Anxiety. And it was one of the better attended fully online webinars done by their talent acquisition team, but they weren't in a position to recruit students. But they were keeping the brand out there, helping the students understand how to be prepared for what's coming next, because this will end, and keeping the brand in front of them. And so I found that to be very interesting, and we've seen an increase in companies doing that now for our students. Specifically to keep them engaged and, I guess the word is, recruitable.
Yeah, you got to keep people engaged, but, you know, again, we're all holding on and waiting to see how long this will, because it will end, but we just don't know when. Again, talking with John Nicolasian, director of the Business Career Management Center at FIU, also with Joshua Ceballos, a graduating senior at FIU, and we want to hear from you if you're just graduating college. Class of 2020, congratulations, but I hate to say it, you're entering the job market at a really horrible time. How has that changed your plans? What are you thinking about your future now? Maybe you're going to stay in school, go back to school. Sometimes people do that. Maybe you're shifting careers because your career might be disappearing. 800-743-9576. That's 800-743-WLRN. Find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. Joshua, has the global pandemic forced you to rethink your career? Are you thinking about changing and doing something else? Because you're very passionate about journalism.
Right. So I fell in love with journalism when I started at FIU. I wasn't sure what I wanted to do, and then I saw there was an opening at the school paper, and I started there, and that's basically been the trajectory of my life for the last 4 years. And I honestly can't see myself doing anything different. And trust me, I've tried. You know, with everything that people say about the journalism job market, I'm like, come on, maybe think of something else that I could possibly do. But I, you know, this is just my passion. It's what I enjoy. So while I've kept an open mind about other jobs, I've started taking a few webinars about data analytics that I had hoped to use for data journalism that maybe one day might translate into something else. My plans have really focused more on like staying in Miami. So forever and a day, I wanted to move out of state, not because I hate Miami, but because I've lived here my entire life, and I wanted to see something different. So I was applying to newspapers in Phoenix and Kentucky and New York, you know, all over the place. And now I'm far more focused on Miami and for the immediate future, living in Miami and reporting in Miami. So I currently work as a contracted reporter for Miami New Times.
Yeah. And just out of curiosity, I mean, you're doing a lot more work remotely right now, aren't you?
Right. Yes. Yeah. So all my work I do from home. All my interviews are phone interviews. I try and get duty-free photos online or have sources send me photos, and our meetings are via like Google Hangouts video call.
John, this is an interesting take. I mean, a lot of people having to work from home and companies now shifting to this. Twitter is moving to almost all their employees working at home. Is that, I mean, first of all, I mean, what are the skills that people have to do that, to work from home?
Well, ultimately, you've got to be, you know, very good about your time and, you know, being able to compartmentalize and, okay, this is my work time, this is my personal time. I laugh when you say Twitter, and we're seeing that trend in the marketplace. And the other piece that we're not talking about there is they're normalizing the salaries for the locations. So that's an even trickier subject because, yep. Yeah, you can leave San Francisco, but you're not going to make San Francisco money if you stay home. So I'm always a little wary of that. I'm kind of like, great. But, you know, good disciplined habits of, you know, being able to work at home, work in a space, having a space dedicated to work. You're basically shifting your brain and like, okay, I'm not in a cubicle and I'm not in my office anymore. I'm in the corner of my dining room or I'm in a separate office at home. So it can be done. It's just I believe this generation is going to be a lot more adept at that than, say, mine or yours or ours. Let's say ours.
That's all right.
For ours, because we've just never been used to that. But there are going to be more jobs like this in the future.
Yeah. Joshua, I wanted to ask you about, because the other part of this is not just the fact that the jobs and the types of work and doing interviews now just remotely has changed for you, but it's also the fact that, look, you just the commencement ceremony and everything that goes with this wonderful time in your life, that had to change too. You didn't have your traditional ceremony. You didn't get your diploma the way I did. How has that affected you?
Right. So I'm a big nerd for like symbols and ceremony and ritual and the importance that that has on humanity and human culture. I think that things like bar mitzvahs, quinceañeras, and also graduation ceremonies are big because they denote a movement from one stage of your life into the other. And it's a clear-cut thing that you can visualize and you have a memory of. So that's what commencement is for graduates. That is the moment where you can officially, unequivocally say, I am done with this part of my life that was all about education. Well, obviously, there's continuing education, but all about college and grade school. And now I'm moving into a new form of my life, a new form of myself. And without that, it's kind of like we've been in this limbo state where it's like, am I still a student? Am I a professional? I haven't really had that clear-cut distinction. And it's made me feel weird. And, you know, I still want to have a commencement ceremony if FIU does one in the fall, just so that I, in my brain, I have that point, like, yeah. I am now different. I am now adult.
It's so strange, and I think I took mine for granted, but now I think about it, what you missed out on, and it is a very important time. Joshua, briefly, what's the conversations you're having with your peers right now about the future?
Everybody's just kind of hustling right now. Everybody is finding new work and finding new ways to do things. I know a lot of people are trying to sell things or are trying to make money here and there. And when it comes to jobs, they're just looking really hard and they're trying to network. All of my closest friends from college are journalism majors as well. And they worked in news and now they're looking for new things. I feel bad for my friend who's a sports writer who is trying to figure something out right now.
Yeah.
But I think it's just a culture of hustle right now, and keep your head down and find something new.
Yeah, and you know what? Sports are coming back at some point soon. John, what's the advice you're giving people like Joshua or that next class coming up? Because we don't know what's going to happen at by the fall. What do you tell them?
The advice has always been the same. You have to have a multi-pronged approach to how you're going to find your next career. It is a combination of, job postings, and even though they're going down, companies are still posting jobs because that's the typical medium that they use. It's also in combination with networking. It's also networking with alumni and peers, just like Joshua had mentioned. That is a well-proven strategy that will yield better results than just the typical, let me just apply online.
Yeah.
You got to hustle and you got to talk to everybody, and it's that multiple pronged approach.
And I love, you know what? It's so true. I think, as Joshua put, it's the hustle. And you know something? It's South Florida. If you grew up down here, you understand hustle. So I think that that gives us
absolutely a
leg up. John Nicolasian, again, Director of Business Career Management Center at FIU, and Joshua Ceballos, graduating senior. Joshua, congratulations. Keep your head up. You know what? Whatever the world's doing, you're going to find your way. I really wishing the best for you.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
John, thanks again for the time. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely a pleasure. Thank you.
And we want to hear more from you. Again, if you're graduating class of 2020 college, tell us about that job search. Find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLR and Sundial. Well, coming up tomorrow on the program, we're going to talk with Fort Lauderdale Mayor Dean Trantalis. We're going to talk about the protests and, again, how the police are handling themselves. You can pose your questions, sundial at WLRN News. Email us. We want to hear from you. Plus, we're going to look at why Latin America now becoming the new epicenter of the outbreak. And drive-in movie theaters are making a comeback. Have you been to one lately? All of that coming up tomorrow on the program. I'm Luis Hernandez. Again, find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial, or email us sundial at WLRNnews.org. We'll talk again tomorrow live.